Good evening.
Good evening.
We have a special treat tonight. Judy's back. Yeah. Welcome. Feeling okay?
So far.
Very glad. Yeah. You look wonderful. She looked great. All right, congratulations. It ain't fun, but what the heck. So we've just started the Platform Sutra. And Judy, the other Judy, has not quite finished the transcription of Coben's talks, which he gave. They're the first talks I heard Coben give, and he gave them on Monday mornings. We would meet in people's living room, mostly in people's houses, people who I thought were very old. Looking back, it seems funny now. Those old ladies weren't really very old at all. And they'd been around, those gals. They had studied with Suzuki Roshi. They were part of the group that formed first at Stanford and then in Los Altos. And Suzuki Roshi used to come down to Los Altos once a week and spend the night, give a talk on Wednesday night, and then have breakfast with everybody on Thursday morning. Ellie did that a couple of times, maybe. And that little group had actually been a part of an experiment at the Veteran Hospital when they were experimenting with LSD. And so I think some of them came to Zen through those experiments. It was before it became a dangerous thing and nobody was doing it anymore. But it was one of those experiences that I think brought them together. Not as druggies, but as learning how to sit. So, for me, it was a great revelation just to be among such marvelous people, such amazing people. It wasn't at all like I had grown up in the suburb of St. Louis, like a very different kind of world. And this is what Coben was talking about, this Platform Sutra. So I'm going to crib from it as we go through and share with you the things that he said about it, because they are still so precious to me, and I think might be for you too. So last week we talked about the poems. The body is the Bodhi tree, or isn't the Bodhi tree, or is the glass, or isn't the glass, or all of the above, or none of them, depending on where you happen to be sitting. Then he goes on to talk about his what happens after he is transmitted in the secret midnight ceremony with his teacher, and the teacher takes him out in the story. The teacher says, "You must go now. It's dangerous. People are after you. People are jealous, and they don't want anybody else taking over this, taking over for me. So you should go somewhere else." And they say the teacher actually traveled with him and crossed the river with him to make sure he was safe. And then he had this famous encounter. where someone was trying to take his, he thought trying to take his robe. It depends on which version you read. Some say he tried to steal the robe and the bowl, and they couldn't come off the rock. They were stuck. But in other stories, including this one, he just, though he was a rough character, when he caught up with me, says Wee Nang, at the ridge, I offered him the robe, and he wouldn't take it, which is a whole nother kind of story. And he said, the general said, I've come all this way for the Dharma. I don't want the robe. So Wee Nang transmitted the Dharma to him there on the ridge. And he said he was ready to hear, and as soon as I spoke, his mind opened up. The story is that he asked the general, what was your face before your parents were born? And the general woke up. So that's not included in here. There were later versions, so the later versions are all enhanced, you could say, through the centuries. But this is supposedly the most pure version of it, the most close to Wee Nang's words. Then he says something very modest and something really clear. He says, I have come here today because I have a connection of many lifetimes with you officials, clerics, and lay people. This teaching has been passed down by the ancients. It isn't something I discovered by myself. But if you wish to hear this, you must listen with pure minds. And if you wish to get rid of your delusions, you should understand it as past generations have. And Coben made a comment about pure, the word pure. He says it isn't pure like pure water. It isn't pure like an empty place where nothing is. He said, it's a pure mind accepts all things as they are in it without any particular desires attached to them. That's what Wee Nang meant by pure mind. Just to accept things as they are. Not wanting them to be something else. Not trying to make them into something else. But just acknowledging and accepting them as they are. That's a free mind. That's a mind that's not anxious. So Wee Nang goes on to say, good friends, this Dharma teaching of mine is based on meditation and wisdom. But don't make the mistake of thinking that meditation and wisdom are different from each other. Meditation and wisdom are of one essence, not two. Meditation is the body of wisdom, and wisdom is the function of meditation. And so we experience that as we sit. The body of it is our body. And as we sit and our mind begins to quiet down, wisdom begins to arise. We can't help it. We can't make it rise. We can't help but become more wise if we allow ourself to sit quietly and accept what comes. Coben said, there's no border internally or externally. The internal world is in accord, or the external world is in accord with your inner world. And we find that when we get up from a sit, things are much more in tune. Things seem to fit better together. Things aren't so discordant. Coben said, wisdom is a very religious term, and it's a synonym of compassion. I sometimes explain it as wisdom is the bird's eye view that we take when we try to see how things are in some kind of clarity. That it means we go and we take in the whole view, everything that we can see. Even though we can't see everything, there's no overall view because we can't see so far. But we can see a lot. And compassion is the mind that's right smack in the middle of everything, right in the middle of the mess, right in the middle of the suffering. And so it's very helpful to feel both of those things without any border, as Coben says, but as both possibilities of our mind. When things are really, really crunchy in the middle of everything, it helps in the mind to just step back a bit and look at a bigger picture. And in the bigger picture, it helps very much to remember to keep a warm heart and to keep connected with everyone and to be willing to endure what everyone is enduring and accept it. So it's a very lively kind of relationship that we have in such a mind. It's a very awake and alive mind. Sometimes we think this meditation is just this sitting serenely and nothing is happening, but a lot is happening. And one way of seeing that is this whole wisdom and compassion and how they are always at work in us. We don't always notice it. And it's one of the great joys of our sitting practice that we offer ourselves the opportunity to notice it, to participate in it, to be it. Fellow students, said Sui Nan, fellow students of the way, be careful. Don't think that meditation comes first and then gives rise to wisdom, or that wisdom comes first and then gives rise to meditation, or that meditation and wisdom are separate. For those who hold such views, the Dharma is dualistic. If the mouth speaks of goodness, but the mind doesn't think of goodness, meditation and wisdom aren't the same. But if goodness pervades both the mouth and the mind, if what is external and internal are the same, then meditation and wisdom are the same. The cultivation of self-awareness does not involve argument. People who argue about which comes first and which comes second only confuse themselves. Unless you put an end to right and wrong, you will give rise to self-existent dharmas, and you'll never be free. And then he goes on to talk about practicing with straightforward mind, which is one of my favorite phrases. I think that's such a wonderful piece of advice. One practice samadhi, one practice sitting, means at all times, whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, always practicing with a straightforward mind. And then he quotes the Vimalakirti Sutra, which we just experienced. A straightforward mind is the place of enlightenment. He says, if you speak about one practice samadhi with your mouth, but you don't practice with a straightforward mind, you're no disciple of the Buddha. Just practice with a straightforward mind and don't become attached to any dharma. This is what is meant by one practice samadhi. Dharma with a small d. Just don't get attached to stuff. Or if you are attached to stuff, be willing to let go of it again. This isn't the teaching that we must empty our houses and take off all our clothes except for one robe and live in total austerity. It just means the kind of austerity that means we're willing to let go of our ideas when they are not relevant, when things don't apply, when it's not real. Straightforward means to be honest. And it seems that so often we're dishonest when we want things to be different from the way they are. The way we ourselves are, and the way things are happening to us and happening in the world. There's so much we would much rather have some other way. And it's not like that. So what do we do with that? We can get very tense and very grim and become exhausted trying to think it into some other shape and form. Don't be attached to them. Be willing to let them go. Sometimes it's hard. I find it especially hard in very close relationships and family, you know, especially with kids. You want your kids to be a certain way, and they never are. They never are. They're always something else. And even your dearest friends are often shockingly something else from what you think they are or you want them to be. And something rises up and says, oh, you shouldn't be that way, or I don't like this, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. There are all kinds of ways of resisting and resisting because it isn't right. But honestly, the only right thing is just to let it be like that and then figure out what to do. Because there's always something that has to be done. If you find your child is in terrible trouble, you have to take care of it. It doesn't mean you just let it all go. It just means you have to see what's going on. And then, you know, buckle up and roll up your sleeves and do something. So again, it's very active, very lively, and very vital kind of practice. Keeps us awake all the time. So he says deluded people think that when they get a hold of one practice, samadhi, they just say that sitting motionless, eliminating delusions and not thinking thoughts are one practice, samadhi. Just wipe out all your thoughts and you'll be fine. But there's no such thing. They just keep coming. He said if that were true, a dharma like that would be the same as lifelessness and would constitute an obstruction of the way instead. The way has to flow freely. Why block it up? The way flows freely when the mind doesn't dwell on any dharma. Once it dwells on something, it becomes bound. If sitting motionless were right, Vimalakirti wouldn't have criticized Shariputra for meditating in the forest. That was a very penetrating little moment. Great bodhisattva Shariputra got chastised for sitting in the forest, trying to polish himself up. He said there are hundreds of people who teach the way like this, but you should know they're greatly mistaken. And then he gives a wonderful image, and I'll end with the image because it'll be nice to take it home. Good friends, what are meditation and wisdom like? They're like a lamp and its light. When there's a lamp, there's light. When there's no lamp, there's no light. The lamp is the light's body, and light is the lamp's function. They have two names, but not two bodies. This teaching concerning meditation and wisdom is also like this. So, are there questions and comments?
I was just wondering why even Kovin said that wisdom is a very religious term. In what sense did he mean that?
I think he means that it's an inborn thing.
So his definition of a religious, something religious, is something that's inborn?
Inborn, yeah. It's something we all experience. And it's very mysterious, and we can't explain it. I mean, we try to explain it, and we have a lot of different ways of explaining it, but none of them is really it. And we know that. You know, we keep trying, but we know it's not possible to really touch it. But we feel it and experience it.
So just a follow-up question. A couple weeks back, Nico was asking about Vimalakirti as that potentially being a sectarian document. Mm-hmm. And then in your answer you said, well, we can take any text and turn it into a religion.
Mm-hmm.
So, in that context, is religion then trying to make a text an inborn thing?
It's trying to reach a way of practicing with the mystery. Finding a way for people to gather together.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow explain themselves and explain the world and the universe and the mystery of it and have some way of enacting it or being with it. And usually it starts out very, very simply. Usually it starts out being very, very quiet. And then, sort of like the Quakers, someone will speak. The Quakers speak when they're moved by the light. And by the light, they mean the wisdom that rises up. And then they're moved by it. And then, with that kind of being moved, some people say, well, gosh, this is really amazing. We should do something more with this. Let's build a little house for it. And we'll all meet in the little house. And then somebody starts to sing sometime when he's moved. And people say, oh, that's wonderful. Let's all sing or chant. The Vipassana group on Wednesday night. In Vipassana, there isn't any chanting and there isn't any singing. But there is a woman in that group on Wednesday night who made up a little song. And every Wednesday night, they sing the song at the very end. May all beings be happy. All beings be free of suffering. May all beings healthy and all beings find peace. And then you go through all my friends and all my enemies and all everybody, and then so
all beings.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's very beautiful when everybody sings. So I think that's just, it's such a natural thing. When I went to Japan, I thought the Japanese temples would be austere, like nothing was there except zafus on the floor. And they're just the opposite of that. They're just as gaudy as you can imagine. They're just bright colors and golden things and big candles. And it's just very, very complicated and complex by now because it's been going on for hundreds of years. And what I've seen in my life is that things rise up and get more complicated, and then it doesn't work for people anymore, and so they start over. Somewhere they start over and say, oh, let's get rid of all of that, and let's just go to the Quaker Center and just sit down. And then somebody says, well, yeah, but we could have a retreat up at Jikoji. We could do something. It just keeps going like that. It's very interesting. And the thing is not to be caught by any of it, not to get stuck in it. So Blanche, when she first got practicing, always talked about how besotted she was with form. She just could not get enough of it. Everything had to be done exactly right. And then she sat with Koven and she saw that even though he knew exactly how to do the form, he was always doing things a little bit differently, but with the same mind, as if he were doing things rigidly the right way. He was doing them with a religious mind, you could say, a deeply respectful mind. So you don't have to do things exactly the same way all the time. You do it as it comes flowing. The wisdom comes flowing out of you as you live it. Yeah, good question.
Somehow you got to anxiety, and I don't remember how.
I don't either.
But to the point that if we experience anxiety, that means we're not here. Right?
It means we're wanting things to be another way. Or we're afraid of the ideas that we're having about what's about to happen.
Right. So when I'm having anxiety, it's attachment to something.
And it's just an idea. It's not real yet. It's just thinking something might happen. So you're not even really prepared for reality because you're bracing yourself for an idea. And it's a hard one to shake, at least in my experience. And I get caught up in anxiety. And it's very helpful to remember that it's just an idea. We don't have any idea what's going to happen next, really.
And sometimes it's hard to know that it's anxiety. You think it's something else.
Yes.
Like, oh my God, I'm having a heart attack because my left side is a little bit weaker.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or whatever, you know.
Right.
It's almost like in the Christian realm, it's almost like the devil is wearing a different hat, so you think it's something else.
Mm-hmm.
So you're faked out, and all of a sudden you're drowning.
Yeah.
How you got there.
Yeah.
And it's different every time. It's like, oh no, that's not anxiety. That's, you know, something else. That's new. I've never experienced that. So
yes, it's real.
You have a right to feel that way, but it's just.
It's just made up.
And I'm making it.
Yes.
Nobody came and said, you know, you're going to have a panic attack now because.
No.
You're making it. And then you feel bad. You know, what's all that sinning about? All this shame.
Yes.
Wake up in the morning, here we are sitting, and then right. Boom.
We should be all better, right? I know. I'm the same way.
No, you're not.
Little do you know. No, it's tough. Life is precarious. And if we focus on the precariousness of it, it can become very, very anxiety provoking. We begin to focus on what we don't know and taking care of ourselves in a way that really means we're not trusting our situation.
And then when you get out of it, it's like everything is clear. It's like, how could I have ever thought that I couldn't get out of this? It's like you're almost blind. Like all of a sudden you can't see. You simply can't see. Like somebody did that and you're going like this.
That's right.
You know, so it's like, is there an in-between?
Sometimes. Mostly.
Or like kind of like, I see you coming, you know, I could feel it coming. Is this
sometimes you just have to let it come and let it be what it is. And often it's like pain. If you allow it, it's not nearly as bad.
Yeah.
Just say, okay, hello.
Have a cup of tea.
Have a cup of tea. Yes, exactly. Wonderful question. Yeah. Paul?
Sometimes it works for me as saying the sutra.
Yes, me too.
Very slowly and intensely.
Yes.
Focus.
Yeah.
After a few repetitions, look back and go, what was that?
Excellent. That's a very, very good suggestion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Works for me.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna cook you too.
Yeah.
You can always hit your head with it a few times.
That helps too. Well, it's after 8, so
yeah.
We have Seigaki coming up. Please save the day if you possibly can, which is Saturday after next. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, 15th. Yeah.
So we welcome and feed the hungry ghosts. And that's always a very nice time. And then we feast. Then we have a feast. So a few of the Wednesday group are going to come too.
A few of the...
Wednesday night. Wednesday, yeah. Yeah. I spoke about it one Wednesday and they got kind of curious. So I think they're coming to check us out. Okay, shall we do our sit?
1 minute sit.